There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Hello, listeners. Did you know Jensen Karp has been doing his Earwolf podcast Get Up On This for over 300 episodes? To celebrate, Jensen is sitting down with hip-hop legend Method Man to discuss his music career, television appearances, From the Wire to the Deuce, and the debut of Drop the Mic, a show that Jensen created and is co-executive producing on TBS. You won't want to miss this engaging, candid conversation with one of the best rappers in the game. So check out Jensen's conversation with Method Man on Get Up On This, available on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or Earwolf.com. And check out his new TV show, Drop the Mic, October 24th on TBS.
Napalm smells best in the evening. It's not worth believing what you heard. Soylent Green, really, just a Triscuit, not a people biscuit.
Hello, you all. Welcome to another episode of I Was There Too. My name is Matt Gourley. I talk to people who were there in the greats and the classics, alongside the leads and the stars and the memorable scenes of film history. Today, I don't do it alone, because joining me as co-host is none other than Steve Agee, friend and fellow Meatballs devotee. We've been watching this movie together and alone for basically our entire lives. And our guest today is Crockett, don't call him Bobby, from the film Russ Banham. Russ turned out to be such a wonderful guy, and aside from playing the dashing camp counselor at North Pines, he's also an incredibly accomplished author, as you will hear us talk about in the interview. He's a Pulitzer-nominated journalist, the author of 26 books, including his international best-selling History of Ford, The Ford Century, and his book on the Airstream trailer called Wanderlust. Just a lovely guy who welcomed us into his beautiful home to discuss this nostalgic classic and favorite of ours. And stay tuned after the interview for a brief discussion between Steve and myself about Bill Murray's character and how he fits in today's context. Also, our quick take on the music from the movie by Elmer Bernstein, specifically the song Good Friend, sung by Mary McGregor, which is just an absolute sentimental favorite of ours. There it is. Please enjoy, and thank you very much to Mark Dowling for making this interview happen.
The film, Meatballs. The year, 1979. The role, Crockett. The actor, Russ Banham.
Russ Banham, I'd love if we could start with you taking us through your audition story. My understanding is you showed up in jean shorts and no shirt. Is that right?
So yeah, so I grew up in Queens, and Long Island, Jones Beach was maybe a 40-minute drive. And in the summertime, I sold hot dogs at Shea Stadium for the New York Mets.
Oh, my God.
And in the mornings, I would just hop in my car. It was a beat-up 1961 Biscayne in a pair of cut-off jeans, no shoes, no shirt, and would drive straight to the beach. And
this, so you would leave with no shoes or no shirt.
Exactly. I mean, because, you know, I'm going to the beach. It was fun to drive with no shoes back then. I don't have the windows open.
I think it's illegal now.
Is it really?
I think it's illegal.
But I love the thought of leaving without it, and there's just no hope of having them all day, so you can't be blamed for living life the best you possibly can.
Well, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I figured, you know, I'll just come back home and then put on shoes, you know, sell hot dogs.
Yeah.
And, a beer, a can of beer, a beer. And that's what I did. And my sister was with me. She's 7 years younger. So I'm guessing I was maybe 22, 23. So she was, you know, 15. And when I got to the beach, I called my answering service. And it was a message from my agent that a producer was in from New York. I'm sorry, in from Canada, in New York, in Manhattan. And he was casting a movie then called Summer Camp. And I needed to get to this audition. I said, well, I'm at the beach. I don't even have shoes or a shirt. She says, well, it's up to you. I think this is a terrific opportunity. So I said to my sister, we're going to Manhattan. And we drove to Manhattan. I left her in the car in the street. She couldn't drive. And I went upstairs into this room. And there were all the other actors in New York who kind of looked like me, who I would always audition against.
Yeah.
And I could just read their brains thinking, he's a genius. Look how he's dressed. He's a genius.
You probably had the tan and everything.
I had everything, yeah. You know, and yeah. My hair, I have curly hair,
yeah.
Not as much anymore. And it was, you know, it had the salt.
Yeah.
Tiness in it, yeah. You know, and I kind of glowed, and then you know, Danny Goldberg was there, and Ivan was there, and I auditioned, and they loved it, and they said, listen, we're going to fly Sarah Torgov, because she was already cast.
Was she Candace?
Yeah,
okay,
my girlfriend. We're going to fly her in tomorrow. We want to see what you guys look like together. And they flew her down, and they looked at the two of us, and we both had curly hair, blondish hair. And I got the part.
Oh my God.
Wow.
No. Serendipity.
You must have just, like, did you even have to speak? You're coming in looking like this perfect summer camp, like, model. I mean,
you know, the audition was mostly improv anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, silly stuff like, throw the basketball to me.
Yeah.
I don't think it really mattered.
No.
Yeah. I just looked right.
How long until you were up in Canada after that shooting?
So we shot for, I would say, about 6 weeks.
Wow.
And it was really remarkable because we were north of Toronto in a town called Haliburton,
uh-huh.
Middle of nowhere. And there was we lived on an actual camp, actual camp on a lake. And we each had bungalows. Right along that lake. Like
your own bungalow?
Well, so each bungalow, it was like a duplex,
okay.
Right. in a way, you know. So I had my half, and then Todd Hoffman, who played Wheels, you know, my best buddy in the film, was right next to me. And then we each had those bungalows. And then there was a lodge where we would gather after shooting all day with the crew. And there was a bar in the lodge, and we would drink.
And a summer camp?
Yeah,
that's
and then
amazing.
We would play poker. And Bill was on the lake, too. And there was nothing else to do.
Yeah.
So we would all gather, and I played poker a lot, you know, growing up in New York. And Bill played poker.
Sure.
And he would always win. And when I asked him why, and he said, well, it's because I cheat. But you couldn't catch him at it. He was
wow.
He was that good. And there was a basketball court there and volleyball. And I think, you know, Ivan... I think he wanted us to live like that.
So that makes sense.
Yeah, we would just get really close. And we did.
Yeah, it does seem like the Meatballs film shoot was just as much a summer camp as the movie Meatballs.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Funny.
And we shot that at another camp that was, you know, ongoing.
Right.
I mean, those aren't extras.
Yeah.
We didn't import them from Hollywood, those little kids. They were going there. And the fellow who plays the... Spaz's dad?
Yeah.
He was the local pharmacist in Haliburton. Yeah.
So to what extent were they the campers, like the little boy with the dead frog or the girl that delivers the gossip? Were they all campers or
all campers?
Oh,
yeah, they weren't cast.
You can tell sometimes in the acting, I think.
Yeah,
but
sure.
It's a noble effort, though.
Yeah.
It's amazing. So they just went there thinking, we'll just cast these kids from the camp when we get there.
Pretty much,
God,
yeah.
And weird. They revolted at some point too, didn't? That's what I read.
Well, now I read that in Vanity Fair, and I did not know that.
How funny!
Yeah. So I would imagine, like, you know, we were the CIT, so we hung out together.
Yeah.
And I would imagine some of the younger actors, they had their own little thing going on, and then the local extras, and all.
Wow.
That scene you have with that little boy and the dead frog. Watching it again today, it's a nice little tender moment, and I'm wondering how much of that in the shoot originally that they peppered in some of the serious stuff, because I know that they went back and reshot more with Rudy. And
it's
did
true.
You have some stuff that you had shot that was later didn't end up?
Oh, quite a bit.
Do you remember any of that?
So there was a there was these strings that ran throughout the narrative that involved me and Todd playing wheels, and we would sabotage the other camps, the ritzy elite
camps. The Mohawk.
Thank you. We would sabotage their cars. So we had scenes like that that eventually ended up on the cutting room floor. Here's a really quick, interesting story. So Todd and I became very close friends for many, many years. And when Ivan brought the film to LA, I was here because I was doing a sitcom on NBC at the time. And Todd said, they're showing Meatballs to the distributors. Didn't have a distributor yet. And he says, I can get us into the projection room. I know the guy. So we went and we watched the original.
And you hadn't seen it yet?
No, hadn't seen it at all. We watched the original Meatballs and it sucked.
This is pre the reshoot scenes.
That's right, pre the reshoot and pre Elmer Bernstein.
Right, which is a
critical.
Huge part of this.
That music, yeah, it really is.
We talk about that song. Now, did he write the Mary McGregor song? He did, because that's in the score, that If You Let Me, I Could Be Your
that's
Good
right.
Friend.
He wrote
Elmer Bernstein?
Yeah. I believe so, because that's also part of the score.
Yeah.
Yeah, with that missing, I would imagine you don't have quite the same film.
It was not good, and even my scenes with Todd, all that was in there, but it just didn't really go anywhere, and it didn't have... It didn't have that, that depth of feeling, the bittersweet, emotions you get from the film now.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't know if it was Harold or Danny or Ivan. You'd have to ask them who made the decision to, to go back to the drawing board. I do know this, that Jeff Katzenberg, who was a production assistant at the time at Paramount, he was the only one in that room of all the studios that liked the film.
The first time?
Yeah, and from what I understand, and I don't know how much of this is apocryphal, but he went to Barry Diller and said, there's something here. And I think they came up with a little money to send it back to Canada in a studio where they shot the scenes with Bill and Chris Makepeace, yeah.
There is something about when you add that music, and I even read something you had said about how you watched it later and how it gives you this feeling of nostalgia. And we've watched it many, many times and we just laugh at it. But this time, this morning when I watched it, I felt not only a nostalgia for the film because I'd seen it as a kid, but also that time in life. And that music, it does kind of like put that bittersweetness in that makes it feel more real or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I grew up going to summer. Were you a summer camp?
No.
Yeah, me either.
Well, I remember we used to go. I grew up Catholic schools. They'd send us on the weekends, the CYO, Catholic Youth Organization, upstate New York, but just for the weekends.
Yeah,
so not for a whole summer.
I went to summer camp from the time I was 8, every summer till I was 14. I ended up being a rock climbing instructor at the same summer camp. It was up in Idlewild,
I have a cabin there.
You do? Yeah, it's beautiful up there. So that's where I spent my summers. My whole childhood was up in Idlewild.
I never went to
camp.
Was
it the arts camp?
No, it's called Pine Springs Ranch, which was...
Oh, yeah.
It's just outside of Idlewild. There's like a Zen Buddhist monastery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's beautiful, that mountain there.
Amazing. Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
I want to talk about something special in this film, which is one of the outfits you're wearing. In the if you can remember this, I'll remind you, at the CIT social dance. So you're wearing a like red cotton cardigan, overalls, but still no shirt. How much choice did you guys have in your wardrobe?
So I can't remember the costumer, but she took us to a, what would you call it? Like a thrift store, a Crossroads we have
Goodwill
here
or something. Yeah.
Yeah. There was just this, hole in the wall place. And she said, just go for it. You know your characters. What would your character wear? And I found that red jacket. After the film, my cousin Billy, who was younger than I, loved that jacket, and I gave it to him. I don't think he has it. I wish I had it.
That would be a piece of memorabilia.
It really was cool looking.
Do you remember your necklace you had? You have a little blue tab necklace.
Yeah, so that was we all had them.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
But I don't know if they're in every scene. At least the guys did. Todd had one too. We just came up with this idea. It was a piece of string, and then it was like a little chip, a little blue chip with a hole in it. And we wore those.
Little brotherhood.
But to me, the most embarrassing costume, of course, is the basketball shorts.
Yeah.
If you've seen clips from basketball in the 70s.
Yeah.
I mean, we're like
they're short
legs.
Shorts, yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah, coming back around. Those shorts are coming back around.
Are they really?
Yeah.
So. That's too bad. Yeah.
By the way, everything, watching that now, everything that Spaz is wearing in that movie, is so trendy and hip right now.
Not only that, but Spaz is supposed to be this social outcast. He's a good looking dude. And I feel like he'd be getting all the ladies today.
Yeah, you know? That's true.
He was also the casting director. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah. And, you know, he's the brother to Len Blum, who wrote with Danny Goldberg and Harold Ramis.
That's
I didn't realize that.
The three of them.
How funny. So was he there when you auditioned, or were they just down there?
You know, that I can't remember. He might have been.
Yeah.
You know? But, you know, he came up with the idea of the Band-Aid, holding the eyeglasses together. And at the time, it seemed novel. It was like, wow, isn't that clever? And, you know, there was no Revenge of the Nerds. You know, he kind of, you know, predated.
Yeah.
It became... Yes,
he's a proto nerd.
Standard nerd.
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, the fact that you would even call a nerd back then spaz just meant spaz. That it's just derogatory in general. Like they hadn't classified nerd, geek, spaz, and that's all that right. stuff like they have now.
Yeah. It kicked off a lot of trends too, because I feel like Bill Murray in that movie, the kind of carefree, you know,
the slacker dude,
didn't care what anyone thinks, became just an iconic character through the 80s, like. Val Kilmer in Real Genius, like it was just a very, especially in comedies.
You know, Bill was a completely unique human being.
Sure.
I'd never seen anything like that before. The only other experience close to it was when I saw John Malkovich on stage in Sam Shepard's True West.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Whoa, what odd choices.
Who was he opposite in that? Who?
Gary Sinise.
Yeah, that's right. I remember when they did that. Yeah. That's right. Was that the first one where they would switch parts? Or am I thinking of the Philip Seymour Hoffman?
You're thinking of John C. Reilly.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, I saw that. I remember thinking, Malcolm, I was like, what is, wow. You know, that's when you realize, geez, I'm not an actor.
No, you guys thought originally Dan Aykroyd was going to play this part, and it was up till the night before when Bill Murray.
Yeah, so that's
confirmed.
What Todd told me. So I arrived. With Cindy Gerling. They flew me in from New York. I landed in Toronto, and then it was a limo picked up. I was like, wow, a limo picked up Cindy Gerling and me, and you know, and then they drove us up to the up to Halliburton there, and she had said. You know, it's going to be Dan Aykroyd. And then Todd corroborated that. So, but Danny Goldberg says, no, it was always going to be Bill. So I don't know who's right.
Yeah.
But I am being absolutely, you know, truthful that the cast thought it was Dan Aykroyd. And of course, when we learned it was not going to be Dan.
You're all bummed out.
Yeah, we were like, oh,
right.
No.
I think they were shooting Blues Brothers at that same time, right?
They might have been. Now, they screened Animal House for us before it was publicly released. So
Whoa.
We had to see
oh,
for
wow.
anyone. Yeah. Wow. Because Ivan produced that.
Yeah.
John Landis directed it. And that was just, you know, blew
it's
us
amazing.
All away.
And Elmer Bernstein did that as
he
well,
did.
Right?
That's
Which
right.
is kind of like, they just like, keep it rolling. Let's go. Yeah. So how was it working with Bill Murray? I mean, I imagine there's no semblance of a script at that point anymore, right?
It was a really basic script with a, you know, very clear trajectory. You had the elite camp, you had the, you know, ragamuffin camp.
Yeah.
And, you know, you sort of know there's this Olympiad. I mean, it was just all pieced together beautifully. And we all did that, although Ivan encouraged us to improvise, you know, our scenes.
Uh-huh.
But Bill... just, you know, made it up as he was going along.
Yeah.
The first time I realized his comic genius was the scene where he's being interviewed.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
Oh, at the bus.
Jerry Aldini.
Yeah, by the way, that's a local guy, too.
Seems familiar to me, that voice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Huh. I think he might have been a newscaster up in that area.
Yeah.
But he was, he's not an actor. And Bill was just riffing on this stuff, you know, talking about... You know, they get this money and then they go around, get all this
sexual awareness week.
Right. From all the different countries. Oh
they have God. To make their way around the world with $2,000 and nothing.
A thermos
of coffee.
We know way too much about this movie.
God, you guys do.
Well, I just watched it this morning, too, so that didn't hurt.
And that liberated us, too, to really go further in our improvising.
So did you guys
none of us had his talent.
Right. But did you... So in a scene like the boat scene with the Candace character, was that pretty much, you knew what you had to do, just however you want to say it?
More or less, yeah. I mean, you know, she likes me, I made that up, and you know, threw my arms up in the air. The whole thing when we're kissing and only my mother calls me Bobby, completely made up.
See, that, now that's a classic moment.
Really?
That,
wow.
That seems scripted.
In fact, I even wrote in here that I want to have a contest where Steve and I both take turns saying Crockett, and you have to choose which one of us does it better.
Steve, you're an idiot.
Go, we're going to do this.
Go.
Crockett. Look at it. He's blushing.
Okay, all right. I got competition. Okay.
He's good.
Crockett.
Steve.
Yeah, it seemed forced.
Yeah,
you seemed like you're acting.
Steve, I can really feel.
Thank you. Right. Thank you. Oh yeah, this is great.
Well, my hopes are dashed. That was the whole reason I set this up.
Okay. Oh, another line that I'll take some credit for this too is when I say you don't see me, I say hardware.
Yeah,
you're a dick. So I did it, for the first time, and Ivan said to me, "I don't understand what that means." It was not. It was such a U.S.
You're a dick?
Now, I like to think I coined it.
You maybe did.
Man, that's amazing.
I certainly coined it for the country of Canada. Because Ivan said, I don't get it. I said, trust me.
What did they use?
A hoser.
Right.
Yeah, of course.
You're a dick.
Oh, my God. That's amazing.
So Meatballs is theoretically responsible for putting dick into the lexicon.
That's correct.
And it's also personally. The benchmark, and they set the bar for every camp movie. Oh, yeah. Afterwards,
it should have been called
Wet Summer. Hot American Summer.
That's a direct reference.
Even
horror films like Friday the 13th, it's still just that feeling of teens away with their hormones raging and that sort of thing. Is this true? Because I read in, I think it was in the Oral History in Vanity Fair, that the actress Christine DeBell, who played AL, who I remember as a kid being so attracted to her and her husky voice. Yeah. Turns out maybe she just had laryngitis during that shoot and doesn't have a voice like that.
Oh, that I did not know. I remember she had that husky voice.
No closer to the truth.
But we all, we all smoked.
Yeah.
Cigarettes and weed. And then every night we would, drink. So, maybe we all had huskier voices than
it could be.
Would be normal for today's teenagers. Because they don't smoke, weed.
No. They all do ecstasy now.
My children don't.
How old are your children?
31, 28, and 13.
You have a 31-year-old?
I do. She got married 2 weeks ago.
You don't look a day over Meatballs, Crockett.
Yeah, you look great.
Yeah.
Wow. I do need to add now that, he's wearing glasses.
Your son is?
Or you.
I am. Yes. Oh,
we're all wearing glasses. Oh,
yeah. That's right, we are.
No. Indeed. Well, no, thanks. You're looking good.
That, yeah. Hanging in there.
How did your character get selected for the high jump? Was that just in the script, or did you have some kind of special attachment to that?
So I think, that was in the script. I know Todd was, he was, I don't think it was in the script per se. I think Ivan sort of picked us somewhere near the end, but I was selected to do that. So I did run track in high school, and I had high jumped before. It's interesting too, because there's that line where I go to Bill and I say, hey Trip, any advice? And he says, jump higher. So when I'm on the speaking tour, as an author, I have a book I wrote called Higher, and I show that clip.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I asked Danny if I could do it. He said, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, that's sure. Amazing.
Yeah.
So they can, they see me as a young guy when you jump higher, and they say,
jump here's very, my new very book. High.
Yeah.
Anything jump else on Meatball high. For you? Meatballs?
I can talk about Meatballs for hours. Was your hair naturally that curly?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Wow.
I had what we called a Jufro. Oh, I could show you pictures. I mean, I had a huge afro in college.
What was the diameter at its biggest, do you think?
Well, I'm going to go like this. You got to tell me. Yeah, because I remember
a Pilates ball.
I'd be doing this a lot.
Just feeling the sensation.
Oh, that's great.
Girls love to feel it, too. They did.
Yeah.
But they kind of trimmed it, and then it got, it was humid up there, and it really, tightened up.
Yeah,
and then it got straighter when my gray hair came in.
Yeah, you couldn't tell you have curly hair right now.
When I was a boy, a picture up there of me, I had straight hair, and then puberty hit and it went, kinky.
Wow.
And then it straightened out. It's strange how that happened.
Yeah.
Your hair's, kind of curly, Steve.
Yeah, my hair used to be really wavy and also way oranger.
Yeah,
like
I
it was like, like carrot top orange. Yeah. And then you get into your 30s and it starts dulling out and
becoming
ashy, and then my beard, I just started shaving all the time now because my beard is just fully white.
Oh, mine too.
Oh,
it's getting there.
Yeah.
Well, we're aging.
Yeah, well, me ahead of you guys.
Can't stop that.
I think you're looking better than both of us put together.
That's for real.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the work you've done as an author. You just showed us this great book that you did on Airstream trailers, and yeah. It actually comes packaged in a metal case that looks like the siding on an Airstream trailer.
It's actual aluminum.
It's the same material, yeah.
Yeah, and the guys who make the Airstreams, you know, they make them one at a time, made the covers for the limited edition of the book.
I'm so fascinated. I work a lot in my own home in renovations, and we're talking about buying an Airstream, renovating it, and using it just as kind of a like a guest bungalow or something.
We talk about that all the time,
really?
Too. Yeah, for the cabin in
Ottawa. Have you ever been to Hicksville Trailer Park out in Joshua Tree?
No, I haven't been to Joshua Tree, but a dear friend of mine has a house there, so we're going to get there. I've seen photos of it, though. Where
they're not Airstreams, like, but they're all vintage trailers, and they're amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what made you transition from acting into authorship? And
so, I didn't grow up wanting to be an actor. I wanted to be a playwright. Uh-huh. That's what attracted me to the theater, and a director. And I was kind of discovered. I was part of a playwrights collective, and we used to read each other's plays, and then we would give criticism, because we were all playwrights. And one time, one of the playwrights said, "Hey, there's a producer we're going to do the reading of my play. Would you mind if he sits in?" And we all said, "Nah, no problem at all." And the producer sat in and decided he liked the play, but he wanted me to be in it. And I was asked if I would be. And I said,
"Were you wearing just jean cut-off shorts and no shirt?"
No, I wasn't. It was actually a very flamboyant gay character. And it was just fun to play, to sort of let loose like that.
Yeah.
And, and it was because he was funny. He was a very funny character. And so we did it at the Provincetown Playhouse in New York. And then an agent came, and then, I was kind of discovered. And one thing, I was on Broadway, one thing led to another. When Meatballs came out, I was famous for about a year and a half. Norman Lear was doing a sitcom called Joe's World, and I co-starred in that with Christopher Knight from the Brady Bunch.
Yeah,
still my
Peter
best
Brady.
Friend. Came to my daughter's wedding, too.
No kidding.
And yeah, we've known each other 40 years. And when that show was canceled, it's Norman Lear's only sitcom failure.
You did it.
That was it.
I was done.
Bummer.
That was it. Yeah.
How was it working with him? I mean, the legend.
He wasn't there on the set often. I remember he was there for the pilot, and then I don't think we ever saw him again. Alan Horn, who had an illustrious career, still does, became chairman of Paramount. He was the producer of Norman's, it was called Tat Communications at the time. But when that ended, I remember I tried to, get jobs for the next year, and he was mostly sitting around by the pool. We were living in Westwood Village and, waiting for the call, and I wasn't getting any work. And I said, I'm done.
Yeah.
So I went back to writing.
You also, I want to hear a story about how you played a guard for the Rolling Stones on a 1978 episode of Saturday Night Live. Is that right?
Yeah, actually, I played. I was in three sketches.
How did that come about?
So Matt Craven, who's just a wonderful actor, of other than Bill
Hardware.
Matt, Hardware, exactly.
Yeah.
He and I didn't even recognize how good an actor he was, when we were doing Meatballs. But I remember Kate Lynch. Came to me and said, Matt's a really, really good actor. And she was right. And he's worked, nonstop ever since we did the film. Anyway, Matt came to New York. I was staying with my parents in between jobs in Flushing. And he came and he stayed with us at the house. And I used to meet Bill for lunch. And I said, come, with us, we'll see Bill.
Yeah.
So we had lunch with Bill.
Wow.
And Bill said, hey, we're going to start shooting the first episode of SNL, The Stones. Are the musical guests and the hosts.
Oh my God.
Yeah. I think it's like one of the only times, Ed Koch made a little announcement, welcomed everyone at the beginning of it. And so, we did three skits. I was in a cheeseburger.
Oh my God.
Whoa.
Yeah. I was in a.
Were you just sitting at the diner or where?
Yeah, we were sitting at the diner. Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah. I had no lines in that one, but I did have one where I had Ronnie Woods. I had a rifle and I was pushing him up against a wall, and he turned to me and he says, "Take it easy, mate." Because I was, method acting. Right up against his neck like that.
Oh my God, I gotta see this.
Yeah.
I know, we're gonna try to dig that up.
You can,
you
apparently.
Can. Yeah. Hulu for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. So what was that night like? Was that a crazy party atmosphere?
It was.
There?
So we spent we went just for one day to watch the Stones. And Dan Aykroyd said, "Hey, to me. He says, listen, can you do me a favor, kid? Would you run? He's like 2 years older than me.
Yeah.
Would you go down to the Deuce and get me some boo? I didn't know what boo was.
Boo? I don't know what boo was.
It was weed.
What?
So back in those days,
like
42nd
how Canadians
Street,
don't know what dick is? Like,
you got to go to Harlem to get weed.
I know. So I asked him what boo was, and it was weed. And you know, went to 42nd Street and used to go to the back of the stores, and there'd be, you know, it was like a bank teller, one of those kinds of deals. And they give you the little glassine envelope and you'd buy a dime. And so I did that. And that's when I smoked dope with, you know, Keith Richards and Danny Aykroyd and Brian Doyle Murray. Here you go, Keith.
Oh, my God.
Keith. Isn't that what Mick calls him? Keith.
Yeah, Keith.
And then Danny says, listen, why don't you guys, I guess he was thinking, I can get this kid to pick me up boo anytime of the day. Why don't you guys, you know, spend all week here? And you can watch the Stones. And we did. And we spent all week. And then we did the show. You know, they shoot it 2 times.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was great. I remember one scene getting ready to go on with Mick Jagger, and I'm sitting on a steamer trunk, and I'm laughing. We're looking at the monitor. We're laughing, and I don't know who's sitting next to me. And I look, and it's Mick, and he's laughing, and his face is this close to mine.
Whoa.
I'm laughing with Mick Jagger.
That's incredible.
I imagine his face, if you were in the same room with him, would always be that close to you. For some reason, he just seems like the presence that would always be inches from your face. You know, he seems like a close talker.
Yeah. Tiny.
Really?
All the Stones, tiny. Yeah. And their women then, who they were with, Jerry Hall and...
Oh, tall models.
Leggy.
Amazons.
Tall. Yeah.
Amazons.
Yeah.
Really. It's kind of shocking.
So what era... This is 78. I'm trying to think what was their album at that point would have been...
Some Girls. I think it was that one.
Okay.
I think wasn't that the name of it?
God.
It sounds about right.
Yeah. You can look up that episode and you'll hear...
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. God.
So yeah, and there's a scene where Mick licks Keith's face, which I remember seeing really shocking at the time. And now it's just, you know, it's old hat.
That sounds
who doesn't
familiar.
Lick your best friend's face?
All the time.
Yeah.
Were they also doing a concert in L.A. or New York at that time? Or
nope.
Just for SNL?
Just for SNL.
Because this was, the second season. Oh, no, it started in 75. So this is like the third season.
Third, fourth season.
Yeah, it would have been a huge hit at that point, right?
Oh, yeah. It was just great.
So what are you working on now?
So I'm writing my 27th book. It's the history of Harvard Business School.
How did that come about? You go from Airstream trailers to
I wrote
Ford?
That book
to Boeing.
The Ford Century.
Yeah.
So that was the official history of Ford Motor Company when they turned 100. Uh-huh. And what's great about that book is my daughter had to do a report on Henry Ford. And so I helped her, and she actually quoted me.
That's
amazing.
That was kind of cool. And Paul Newman wrote the foreword for that book, 600 words. And I wrote 60,000 words, and his name's as big as mine on the cover. But I'm sharing billing with Paul Newman.
Not bad.
And then I wrote the history of Boeing, and then I wrote some biographies. I did a political economic history called The Fight for Fairfax, and... It was, weird. It was just,
About the street Fairfax or that whole district?
Oh, that's it. Yeah, the fight for Fairfax. Yeah, it takes a look at Fairfax County, Virginia.
Oh, okay.
Which was it's the fastest growing county and richest county in America since World War II. And that's right after we won World War II.
Right.
Washington, D.C. was too small to accommodate the intelligence and defense agencies that needed to grow so we could be a superpower. So Montgomery County in Maryland and Fairfax County in Virginia, which was nothing but scrubland, vied to become sort of the extension of Washington, D.C. And it's a pretty great story.
So is it just like a suburban community of intelligence?
Wow. I drove around. So University of Virginia and George Mason University commissioned the book. And I remember driving around. I don't want to give you his name, but he's a very, very wealthy real estate developer in that city.
Donald Trump?
No. God, no. Please. And I would say to him, I said, so he's actually the guy who built Tyson's Corner.
Okay.
And I would say to him, so what's that building there? And he's like, I could tell you, but I'd have to kill you afterwards. Because, it was CIA.
Yeah.
NSA, something like that. So that's where they all are.
I can't imagine if living in that neighborhood would be a blessing or a curse. Like, your secrets would be safe, but you would also have no secrets.
Right.
Right.
So, keeping up appearances would almost be impossible with all the miking and tapping. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Russ, we can't thank you enough for this.
Oh,
this
you guys.
Oh, my God. Total joy.
Yeah.
To look back at that film. You know, I tell people I could write 100 books and the obituary is going to read Meatballs co-star dead at, you know, 80.
Don't call me Bobby.
Yeah.
Don't call me Bobby.
That's exactly. This is your memoir title.
The last sentence will be, he also wrote books.
27 books.
Thanks,
there
Russ.
You go. Thank you.
It's
been a pleasure.
Thanks again, Russ Banham, and thank you, Steve Agee. And speaking of Steve Agee, as mentioned in the intro, we wanted to have a quick conversation about watching Meatballs in today's context and Bill Murray's character specifically. This is something that came up with us long ago and made Steve mention that at one point it made him difficult to watch this movie that he loved. And then this conversation segues nicely into a discussion about Elmer Bernstein's score for the film and specifically this song that the both of us just absolutely love called Good Friend by Mary McGregor, which we'll play right after this short little discussion. Also, there's a surprise appearance from my new adopted daughter. Thanks for listening. You can find out more about I Was There Too at Matt Gourley on Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd. Also, I Was There Too on Twitter. And if you get a chance, give it a 5-star review. Give it a 7-star review if you can. All right, here's the segment. All right, Steve.
Oh, my God.
For years.
What just happened?
Well, first of all, if you didn't hear it on the mic, Russ Banham is a charming piece of a man.
Yeah, very charismatic. That was better than I could have hoped for.
He's just a specimen.
Good-looking guy. The years.
Oh.
I was wondering about that. Do we leave that in or are you going to edit that in?
Well, I'll leave it in, but I'm going to turn it off. You tell him what it is.
Gourley has a...
Hey, I just want to hug you. Hey, you don't play fair and you're making me angry.
Gourley has this little doll that's on rollers and it's got a motion sensor, but it looks like a little dead girl. She has green skin and hollow eyes and white hair.
You should mention this is for Halloween. It's not like I just...
Yeah. It's a Halloween decoration, but it rolls around the living room and it just... It's motion censored, so it just goes off at random times.
Yeah, they can't.
Like now.
Anyway, we've been watching this movie for years and about maybe halfway through our probably decade-long sharing of this movie, it occurred to me that Bill Murray's character, if you were to take it out of the context of this movie, would be the most insufferable human being. In fact, we've probably known people like this, someone who's always on, who's like nothing short of an absolute sexual assaulter.
I think basically the best way to describe them is exhausting.
Yeah, like they require all the attention. This guy hangs out only with younger people. There's no one there his age.
Well, it is a camp, so
I know,
there's not a lot of options.
But it's probably because all of his friend group has ostracized him, and he can only go hang out with people that will look up to him just because of his age. If you watch it in that context, it changes the movie completely. And I remember I said that to you one time, and you were worried.
I was like, you might have ruined the movie. But I hadn't watched it in probably a year or more, and then when you asked me to come sit in with you and co-host this, knowing my love of the movie Meatballs, I watched it again last night, and I'm still in love with this movie.
I have to say, same here, because there was a while where I had a little bit of a tough time watching it, just feeling like it was too much, but for some reason, the nostalgia really crept back in this time.
Meatballs also just kind of set the bar. It was the late 70s, but it set the bar for comedies in the 80s, especially teen comedies and the like, where there's always one of these characters. The kind of, he's always on, doesn't care about authority.
Again, this is a real person, they would be like despicable.
Well, if they walked into a party, everyone would be like, oh, I'm gonna go get some punch and like kind of walk away.
Like in real life, we're all Mickey, we're all Morty in this movie. Like, oh god, this guy, get him out of here, he's at every party.
Yeah, but he has become an iconic character, or not character, what's the word I'm looking for, it is like
Like an archetype?
An archetype. That's exactly what I'm looking for. Like I think I said this earlier, it's Val Kilmer in Real Genius.
Right.
And all these movies had in the 80s had a character. And I think Meatballs was the first one.
The best I can figure as well.
And also, the nerd character, I think, came from Meatballs.
Yeah, we talked about that, too, on the interview. And then the other thing I want to cover, too, before we wrap this up, and we'll go out with this, is this, not just the Elmer Bernstein score, but this song. And it's called Good Friend by Mary McGregor. It's written, I think, by Elmer Bernstein. Uh-huh. And you and I have sung this forever.
It's so funny.
We've used it in Super Ego for the end of shows.
Yes.
It is the sweetest song.
It's a great song.
This played at my wedding in the pre-ceremony music.
It did?
Yeah, like when people were sitting down.
It's a great song.
It is the sweetest, most like innocent, beautiful little song that I think I've ever heard.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so we'll go out with that. And Steve, if you'll let me, I could be your good friend.
Matt, I will.
Crockett.
Don't call me Bobby.
Hello, everybody. My name is Jensen Karp, and I am the host of a show called Get Up On This right here on the Earwolf Network. We've been doing it for over 300 episodes, so we're celebrating by sitting down with a hip-hop legend, my favorite MC, Wu-Tang Clan founding member Method Man. That's right. For over an hour, we talk about his music career, songs he's released. We talk about his television appearances from The Wire to the brand new show The Deuce, and also the debut of Drop the Mic, which is a show that I created and co-executive produce on TBS. It debuts October 24th at 10:30. It's where celebrities rap battle against each other, and I swear to you, it's better than that sounds. I promise you that. But listen, you could download our episode now at Apple Podcasts or on the Earwolf Network and listen to an engaging conversation, sort of candid. A lot of stuff comes out with literally one of the best rappers in the game still, Method Man. We hope you listen, and whatever. Have a good time.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.